Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, where you get multifamily investing made real. Learn from top players in the real estate investment world as they share their secrets with you and discover proven strategies on apartment investing that actually work. To learn more about Wheelbarrow Profits, visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. Now to your hosts, Jake and Gino.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senziano, host of Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, father, six, best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Mr. Senziano, I'm doing good, bro. How are you?
Always making it happen, big man. Guys, we've been incredibly busy with business development and acquisitions, but our team has been pushing the G-Dad, Mr. Purple there, and myself to do more and give back to our communities. So this year, we are officially launching the charitable arm of our family of companies, Rand Cares. This Thanksgiving, Rand Cares is going to feed thousands of children by partnering with the Second Harvest Food Bank of Tennessee. The Second Harvest Food Bank is a tremendous organization that has paved the way in trying to end hunger in our community. Their commitment is to use 96 cents out of each dollar, and that's going to go directly towards the cause. We are so incredibly excited to be partnering with them on such an important issue. I think that we can all agree that children should not go hungry, especially during the holidays. If you'd like to join the cause, click on the link at the top of our homepage, jakeandgino.com, to donate. Our food drive will run from November 1st to November 16th. So, G-Dad, let's get our asses in gear and let's do our part to feed the kids. Today's guest is Garrett Gunderson. Garrett is the founder and chief wealth architect of Wealth Factory and New York Times bestselling author of Killing Sacred Cows. He's personally helped countless business owners create efficient wealth strategies that fit their unique strengths. Garrett and his team are on a mission to manufacture economic independence for 1 million entrepreneurs by 2020. So without further ado, Garrett, welcome to the show.
What's up? Good to be here. I'm looking forward to this, guys.
Oh, hey, Garrett. Get it crunched up, man. I love it. So why don't you give us a little bit of your background and how you got into business and what spurred all this on here, the Wealth Factory and everything?
Yeah, I grew up in this small coal mining town called Price, Utah. Even before that, East Carbon, Utah. I actually recently went back to East Carbon. It was a town at its height of 5,000 people and two cops. Now there's 1,000 people and five cops. So you can tell this is not a nice place to be. It's where dreams go to die, my friends. I'm pretty sure, you know? So I grew up there. And then when I was 15, I basically wanted to start this business because I was playing sports. And my parents were like, well, you can't really get a job and play sports. We'll just kind of support you a little bit. And I was like, yeah, but I want extra money. I want to be successful, or whatever that meant at that time. And so my dad, being a coal miner, would bring home surface mine vehicles when the bosses would come to town. I'd help them clean them up. My mom worked for a credit union, so I went to her boss and said, I could clean these vehicles when you repossess them so you could sell them for more. And my first official business at 15 was launched, innovatively named Garrett Gunderson's Car Care. Man, that one took a long time to come up with, but yeah. So I became a speaker shortly after, because 6 months in that business, I presented at a Students in Free Enterprise panel. It was a competition for rural young entrepreneurs, and I'd only done about $600, $700 in net income. And in one talk, I won $500. I was like, dude, screw like cleaning cars, man. I'm gonna start teaching. So no, I actually continued that business for a while. I won the Young Entrepreneur of the Year for the state of Utah. Won $5,000, tried to invest that money thinking it was a lot of money. I had to have a custodian sign off, but my mom is this Italian lady that her money management philosophy was putting money in coffee cans and putting them in the cellar. So she wasn't gonna let me invest. And that's kind of how I got my career started, by asking a lot of questions, getting offered an internship, which pretty much meant I was peddling mutual funds and life insurance. I've had to repent for years for my wrongdoings there, you know? But when the stock market went down in 2000, I actually started doing a boatload of real estate at that time and kind of moved away from the stock market. And I got, unfortunately, a little bit lucky originally with real estate. So I confused skill and luck. And so I overextended and overleveraged myself there for a while because I thought I was Midas and everything I bought was going to turn to gold. And I didn't need to know the numbers or have good exit strategies or any of that kind of stuff. So I feel like a lot of my career in writing my books was more confessionals where I figured out the way not to do stuff. And rather than defend those, actually say, here's the biggest lessons I've learned and what you could kind of learn from it too. And hopefully not, you know, repeat the same mistakes.
This may be a tough question, but what do you think is the biggest myth for investors to overcome?
I think scarcity is the biggest myth, man. Mm-hmm. I just think the fundamental belief that there's not enough, that it's based upon circumstance, that if someone else is wealthy, we have less, feeling any guilt, shame, or wrongness around money because of things we heard our parents or preachers or teachers say, and a lot of our early teachers or government workers being paid by an institution that's very limited in the value that it creates, it really permeates the world. And so people feel this very defeatist type of mentality that they don't understand value creation at a significant level. And they think that somehow you're born into wealth because of a hierarchical society that you see a lot of times in Europe. And unfortunately, it gets them to do nothing of great consequence.
So I love the book. I told you I bought it back in 2008. I bought it again 6 months ago, and I can't believe I forgot to read it. Back in 08, I was not financially free. Now I am, and every single thing resonates with me, whether it's your sole purpose, whether saying that 401ks may not be appropriate. Where should a potential investor who, everyone should out there listening, their goal should be to become financially free. Then you can start Iran Cares, because if you're not, I can't be on this podcast with Garrett right now because I'm paying the bills. I can't help other people because I'm focused on myself. When you become financially free, you don't focus on money. You focus on creating value, and value is what creates the money, right? Money's not the cause. Money's the result. So where would you want a person listening to this who's 24 years old, where should they start focusing on to become financially free?
I think that they've got to invest truly in themselves and figure out, like, what is their ultimate skill set? How do they develop that skill set? And then just continually ask the question, how do I reach people with the skills where I'm delivering value, solving problems, or serving others? And how do I more deeply impact people or reach more people with that? Because that's going to really drive their income. If they're thinking about 30 years from today and then just putting money into some retirement plan, there's no cash flow in it, there's no security, there's no control, no exit strategy, and ultimately, dude, think how crazy a retirement plan is. You're partnering with the government. The government's $21 trillion in debt, and you're going to partner with them? We would never partner with that big of an a-hole in life, yet somehow we start doing that. It baffles me that people are being convinced.
It's safety. The government's safe. Come on, man. That's the safe spot.
Yeah, imagine if like a real estate partner came along and like, hey man, I don't really create my own income. I just take income from other people and I'm 21 trillion in the hole. Like to count to 1 trillion, it takes 37,000 years, right? Like think about a trillion. Now there's 21, at what point do we go, this is like video game numbers. This is like a Spaceballs movie. Like it just doesn't even seem real. And somehow people are still signing up for it because they've seduced us. They've created this like marketing and made it sound really great that it's tax savings. There's no tax savings in a retirement plan. It's tax deferral. You didn't save money in your pocket. It's stuck inside of a plan that you don't own or control. So anyway, that's just a little diatribe there.
Let's dive into the 401ks because I really want, you had a great article in the back of the book of the many misnomers. And the first one is, I always think an investor should have leverage, liquidity, and control. Those are the three tenets of any investor. So break it down. Real estate doesn't really have the liquidity, although I can refi the property, I can pay the deed. There's certain elements of liquidity. A 401k, you have no control over it. It's stuck in there. You're feed to death. You have no control over your whatever you're investing it in. So you take it away. I want you to continue to hammer it away.
Dude, I see people, this is crazy, where they take real estate and put it in a retirement plan. Here's my problem with that. Real estate gives you tax advantages that as soon as you put it in the retirement plan, you can no longer depreciate it for tax purposes. Mm-hmm. You've eliminated that. Real estate is a capital gain asset. If you've owned it longer than a year and you sell it, that's a capital gain. That's a lower tax rate. If you put that inside of a retirement plan, it all becomes ordinary income. Like it's, so it becomes especially bad with real estate. But I look at it like, okay, I define economic independence of having enough cash flow or recurring revenue coming from assets to cover your basic life expenses, right? When you're no longer in survival mode, you can start to really thrive. And when you get to that economic independence level, you get an unfair or insider advantage where you can swing for the fences in value. If you're locking money away for 30 years, where you can only borrow up to $50,000 of it, but you have to pay it back on a schedule, you have to pay it back with post-tax dollars, it's typically invested inside of mutual funds without much control. And I got to tell you, you know, at the time that we're recording this, if people are in funds, they are just giving their money away at this point, because there's nothing that makes sense in the stock market right now from the valuations, from the all you have to look at is how much money exists in the world and how much of that's valued inside of the stock market. It is in a very fragile state. And yeah, it gets people to stop thinking about like results, because you don't, 30 years from now, that just seems so far away. I mean, it just seems like it's an easy way to get distracted and not think about what's really happening.
Mm-hmm. The biggest mistake that I see middle class do is they try to save for an event, whether it's saving for college or saving for retirement. And to me, I found that that's a very inefficient way to do it, because once you put money away for college, it's gone. But if you buy an asset, that asset will continue to generate revenue, maybe depreciate, like real estate. What do you see as the biggest mistake that the middle class?
By the way, you just articulated something that 99% of the population doesn't get. Mm-hmm. And it's so critical. I hope it sinks in for everyone. It's like, I don't have a college fund for my kids. Like,
it took me a long time, though. I had this guy across the mic with me, and it took me a long time to come to that realization, because I felt guilty. Because everyone you talk to is, you have retirement set up. First of all, I'm not retiring. This is me retiring right now, okay? So that's gone. So
I'm in agreement with that, too.
Yeah, the second thing is, I have six kids, and I'm getting cash flow from a property that can pay for them. And I'm going to continue to do that with the remaining six. So everyone at the time was like, when I had my sixth child born, they're like, are you nuts? How are you going to pay for their wedding? So that's what they're focusing on. So I have this big guilt saying, I need to put away money in 529s. And I was almost going down that path until I said to myself, that doesn't seem like the right way to do it. So, you know.
You nailed it. That's like, and I look at wealth as, you just maximize your opportunities. Don't fractionalize them. Don't fragment things off where you lose power. It's kind of like, I look at the Amazon River as a very powerful river, but I look at creeks, they dry up all the time. Like, build a powerful flow, maximize that flow. And if you choose to take some of that to do something, then you can, but yeah, have regular cash flow. I feel like if people just understood cash flow investing versus accumulation, this would transform their life, because scarcity is usually born of the accumulation philosophy. And the formula for accumulation comes down to this. The belief is that if you want wealth, it's a function of three factors. Number one, how much money can you put away, right? And so that's the whole myth of, it takes money to make money. It doesn't take money to make money. It takes mental capital and relationship capital and value creation and service and solving problems and building. Like, there's so many ways to make money. But if we have this defeatist mindset of, it takes money to make money, by the way, that's a brilliant thing for institutions to say. This is probably why I get kicked off CNBC, is like, I'm like, hey, it doesn't take money to make money. People that tell you that want your money. It's not taking their money to make money, right? And then the second part of accumulation is, you got money times rate. So most people are being trained, taught, and educated that high risk equals high return, which is a silly notion, because risk equals chance of loss. So the higher your chance of loss, the lower return you're going to typically get. Sure, there's those 1 in 100,000 deals or 1 in 1,000,000 deals that pay off, and people pay attention to the wrong thing rather than the fundamentals. So they believe risk equals return, so they're putting away hard-earned money, taking unnecessary risk with it. And then the third component is time. This whole notion of Einstein saying that compound interest was the eighth wonder of the world is a flat-out lie. I don't know if you guys have heard that notion that, you know, he said that. But I looked it up. We did the research. I have a guy, Steven, on my team. He found it. In the 1920s, Security National Life put out an ad. They were misquoting Einstein from a conference in Austria where he said, compounding numbers are the eighth wonder of the world. Compounding numbers, not compounding interest. So then they bastardized it to get people to separate themselves from their money. And when we think about it, institutions are brilliant, because they just want four things from people: their money, all the time, hold on to it for as long as possible, and give them back the least possible, is their four rules. So it has nothing to do with cash flow. It has everything to do with accumulation. And if all you did was shift your mindset from accumulation to cash flow, it would transform your finances and say, how do I get assets to create cash flow? How can I create recurring revenue? How can I make it that I don't have to get up and go, you know, hunting to kill the food and get the money, but that's already done so I can choose what I do every single day? That's a completely
different— why I don't want to sell our apartment buildings. That's why. Why kill the golden goose? It's the biggest thing. If they cash flow, you keep them and you love them and you nurture them. That's it.
Right.
I agree. So, Garrett, there's a few things I have to unpack from there. First thing, who knew in the 1920s there was fake news? I thought fake news just came about now. So I guess back in the 1920s, we had fake news too. The second thing is the dollar cost averaging just blew that myth up. That's a joke in and of itself. Continue to give me money every month, not knowing where it's going to go, not having any control over it, but just give it to me every month and you'll average your losses and your wins. That's a moronic thing.
Who wants to be average? It says average in it. It's stupid.
That's right. And the third thing Jake and I always talk about is transactions will pay the bill for you, right? Equity will make you rich. So I think from what you've cut, you pulled out, a lot of single family home guys and a lot of guys doing fixes and flips are transaction guys. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't want to bash that. But at the end of the day, just look at, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. You're in a different tax bracket than we are. You're in a different mindset than we are. We are in accumulation and actually adding to our cash flow so we can continue to buy these things. So just, when you're going through a strategy, figure out where the best tax benefits are and figure out what your strategy is. I mean, that's what happened back in 07 and 08. We were all looking for cap appreciation. Cash flow was non-existent. I think now you can still buy assets that are cash flowing. We're not back in 07 because we're still buying assets that are cash flowing rather well. So I don't equate the market as being as frothy as back then, but I totally agree with what you've been saying.
I call it make money on the buy. I like it because if it's cash flowing, you've made money on the buy. Mm-hmm. Like that speculation of only making money on the sell, that should be gravy. That should be awesome. That's part of the whole plan, but not the only factor.
So I think the most important thing in the book to me was your sole purpose. Man attracts not what he wants, but what he is. And that really hit me 3 months ago because I'm a life coach. And I was like, crap, I'm sitting in the kitchen like this, acting like an idiot. Of course, I've got idiots working for me. It's not their fault. I'm the idiot that's attracting them, right? And now I'm attracting different people. But that sole purpose really hit me. And that's probably why I'm enjoying this part of my life more. Can you go into that a little bit and how it really attaches to wealth creation and why being wealthy is really cool if you can do it along with your sole purpose?
Yeah, I mean, like there's some really key distinction with sole purpose. I'll define it first. Mm-hmm. Take your values, then you add in your abilities, and then you bring in passions in the end. And that there's a unique combination of those three things. Now, when you set context of your biggest outcomes and vision, right? I feel that vision is the rarest commodity in the world. People with really clear, compelling vision have so much power and value because it allows other people to achieve more because of the vision that they've created. So sole purpose is who we are at the core. And we're either doing things that pull us forward at the greatest rate and is aligned with us or not aligned with us. And so a lot of people are out of alignment with their sole purpose in the name of they believe it, that hard work is what it takes. But the thing is, it's doing the right hard work. And a lot of people are doing the wrong hard work. The right hard work is discovering your sole purpose. The right hard work is thinking about your vision and taking time to think and not just do, so that you're doing actually the right things. And so the other kind of confusing part with sole purpose is some people think that it's all about passion. And sometimes passion is merely hobby and not value. Like hobbies are really meant for the individual, which is definitely valuable, but it's not going to be monetarily rewarding in most cases. So purpose, when we take that and apply it out there in the workforce and out there for other people, that's where we can actually make substantial money from it. So I think that there's a lot of books in the past that talk about having passion. And the problem is passion can lead us quickly in the wrong direction. And we've got to take into consideration value, ability, and vision. And once we get really clear about that, I feel like it's a lifelong journey. And I feel like retirement defined is when you found your sole purpose. And why would you ever retire from living your sole purpose? That makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, like the way that finance and retirement is planning is to bankrupt a family. Like build wealth, extract that wealth to live while doing nothing. And look, even when I was in Italy for 2 months, there's certain days where I just would like to be more engaged in the world. And you know, there's only so many gelatos, coffees, and pizzas I can have in a certain week where I'm eventually like, I want to do some writing. I enjoy that work. I bring that forth. And so I'm now, I've said plenty. I know you've got some good.
No, I want to jump in on this because I, when I got out of college, I went to be a personal trainer. And everyone's like, oh, I follow your passion because I enjoyed working out. I stopped wanting to go to the gym because I had people telling me how much they hated being there and they didn't want to do it. And it pushed me to do this. And I'm like, screw this, man. And so follow your passion. It sounds great and everything. But when you get really damn good at something and you're making a lot of money and you're changing people's lives and you're growing something, that's when you really drop the hammer and things start moving, because that's when you're engaged, you're being successful. I want to reserve the gym time for myself so I can go and enjoy that and not bring people into it that are actually going to create a negative experience for myself. So that's when that kind of light bulb went off for me at an early age. It's not all about following your passion. If you get good at it and you're doing something that you like and you're good at, that's when things are going to fast forward for you, not because it's something that you enjoy doing. I'd love to be a baseball player and would have, you know, loved to be in the World Series this year, but you know, that's not working out for me so well right now. So I think find out what you're good at, and then really start to excel that, and magical things can happen. So.
Great point.
So Garrett, a guy who's written great books and he's probably done an amazing job in business, how did you get kicked off of CNBC?
So CNBC, I come on, and this was 2008, and it was before the market really started to decline. And this British guy goes, "Hey, where's a good place for people to invest their money?" I said, you know, the problem with the term investing is most people think it's synonymous with stocks. And right now, it's a horrifically bad time to invest in stocks. And for 70%+ of the population, it will always be a bad time because they don't know anything about it, why it's going to work, what stocks they're actually holding. They don't understand the fees that are associated with it. And the next thing I know, it's just dead air. Like, I'm not on set. I'm in like an earpiece looking into a camera. And I never heard like dark, quiet, goes to commercial, I guess, and they never invite me back. They never respond to my emails. It was just like, yep, this guy is disagreeing with our advertisers, and this is going to be bad.
That's
for
exactly
CNBC.
Right. Yes.
With our mantra. But you know what the funny thing is? Like you said, you could have just elaborated and said, hey, listen, first we have to learn the difference between the word invest and speculate. When you buy a stock at 30 without dividends and looking to sell at 40, that is speculation. That's not investing, right? So when you're buying a single family home looking to flip it, that is not investing. That's speculating. So the first thing they should have said is, okay, maybe he's right. So no big deal about not jumping back on there. I could, you know, who cares about those guys? Because
it's so funny because my buddy Jared Yellen was in New York at the time working out, and he used to work on Wall Street. He called me, and I look at my phone. I think I'm still on the air, and then I don't answer. And he's texting. He's like, "Dude, what happened?" It's like that guy's eyes were so big, like they couldn't believe what you just said. I'm like, "Well." Uh-huh. You get the same version of me in all settings, I guess.
That's right. I love that. When a client comes to you, where do you first start out? How can you help clients that are looking to create that wealth?
The first place we always start is keeping more of what they make and boosting the bottom line. So there's four main areas. I call them the four I's. The IRS, this is one of the biggest bills that people have. So if we can help them save tax, that's an immediate return that can actually continue year after year. Number two, we look at interest. Have they negotiated the best interest rates, structured their loans properly? Do they have the right credit score, cash flow reporting, the right connections, the right collateral? So we're just looking to get that money back and put it back into their life. The third thing is investments. If they have any investments, we want to see if there's any non-performing fees or unnecessary exposure. And we want to eliminate non-performing fees and unnecessary exposure so they keep a lot more money. And the fourth I is insurance. And in insurance, we don't save them a ton of money usually. We usually just get them a lot better coverage for the same dollar. Because I have a fundamental belief, insure the catastrophic, not the inconsequential. The most expensive dollar of insurance is the first dollar you buy. The least expensive is the last dollar you buy. But the last dollar is the important protection because those are the higher amounts. So you're less likely to use them, but if you do use them, it's catastrophic. So we just make sure there's no duplicate coverages or improper structure and get them better protected. So the first focus is let's put more money in their life. The second focus is going to be what makes them the best investor? Who are they with their investor DNA? Because now we found money, they can invest in things and we get them to focus instead of diversify. Diversification is a playing not to lose game for people that have a huge amount of wealth and they need to store value. It's not a growth game. Growth game is focus on what you know, But the way that we help them with that is build the right foundation and safety so they have permission to focus without being overly exposed to risk. So that's the first beginnings with people.
I love that. So everyone listening, just take a second, stop the recording, and I want you guys to actually get out your paper, IRS, interest, investment, and that fourth one, insurance. List all your insurances. Do you have whole life? Do you have boat insurance? Do you have an umbrella policy? Do you have home, auto? Go into all of them. And you know what? It's hard work and it's not easy, but nothing easy in life is easy. Nothing worth it in life is easy. So work on those four. I mean, that is one of the best tips we've had on our shows in over 3 years. Work on yourself and that insurance aspect of it, protect it, because that is the moat around your castle. If you don't have a good moat protecting your assets, you can be the best investor in the world and you're toast. Am I correct?
That you nailed it. That's well said. I think that when we hear that there's a negative savings rate in America, the reality is there's a positive savings rate, but it gets dipped into because they don't properly protect themselves and they're one financial surprise or incident away from that wealth being confiscated. So we are all in store for financial surprises. We can prepare for 90% of them with a little bit of planning. So
I love that. So you've scaled up your company tremendously. You're doing a lot of work. How have you built teams and what advice do you have for team building?
Well, there's several pieces of team building. Let me give you the number one thing that makes a team work that most people don't understand. And it's that most people that become successful do it partially through bad habits. I mean, it's good initial habits, meaning just working like relentlessly and doing whatever it takes. But eventually you hit a point where you only have so much capacity. And if you want to have a quality of life, it competes with a business success unless you change the rules. And the way I change the rules is I hire people and I have them own their role. Here's your role. You're the CEO of that role. I delegate that role to them and I say, you come to me for support, but I'm counting on you like you're running that part of the business and I don't have to micromanage. Most people only relegate instead of delegate. They give someone a task, hope it gets done. It's like a boomerang. It comes back to them. I don't delegate tasks. I let people choose the task, telling them what the conditions of satisfaction are in the end, and they get there in their best path. And if they're missing out on time or they're not getting there, their job is to come to me, not me to manage them. Frees up massive amounts of time. The second thing is you only hire, like, I feel like the game is won half the time when the teams are picked. So I'm like, I want to pick the best team. Who are the superstars and what is it going to take to have them on the team? And I make sure in writing my books and in being on TV that I'm using that as much to recruit my team as my clients. And I really am looking at, like, who are the best products of our product? There was a guy in 2005. He was an airplane engineer, like rocket scientist kind of guy that, you know, was just trying to become wealthy by never spending a dollar. And no one shrinks their way to wealth. So he came to one of our workshops. And at the end of the day, he said, I'm going to become economically independent in a year. And so he spent an extra 20 hours a week buying real estate and creating enough cash flow to cover his life's expenses. And he got there in 362 days. Then he came to me and he said, hey, I loved your program. Here's a few missing pieces I wrote about. And it was this process called cash flow optimization. I hired that guy because I'm like, this guy's a product of the product. So we always go to our top relationships and we even go to our subscribers and say, who do you know? Or are you someone that completely buys in and believes in what we do because of who you are? And so I think about Dale's been with us since 2005. We have a guy, Brandon, that's been with us since 2007. We have another guy, Wade, that's been with us since 2010. We don't have a lot of turnover because we're really searching for the very best people that we could possibly get. And we make them read Killing Sacred Cows. We make them do a book report on it. We make them write a cover letter. And anytime someone says, oh, I don't have a resume, we're like, we didn't ask whether they had a resume. The fact that they're telling us that means they're no longer an applicant because an A-teamer just sends the resume even if they have to create it. So we create like all these conditions up front that people have to jump through the hoops. And like I just hired a writer last week. I wrote a Facebook post that was like so long that only a writer would read it, right? I'm like, here's the intro to my new book. And so we got 7 applicants off that Facebook post. Those were really good applicants because we then made them go through all these hoops, and for them to get through the hoops, by the time they talked to me, I only did one interview. It was the final interview. And the way, and here's kind of the secret of that. I had this guy, Rich Christensen, I hired him to consult me, and he said, what's the values of your firm? So I showed him the values. And then we wrote 5 to 7 interview questions on each of the values of the firm, but we never tell the interviewee about the values. So like, I have this whole thing about being empowered. So I think, what are the questions that'll let me know whether this person's entitled? So I'm like, how do you feel about unions? They don't know what the hell I'm asking that for. But if they start raving about a union, interview over, right? So it's like, you can't game the system. I'm not asking normal questions. I'm asking them questions like, you'll love this. Like on the question of value creation and money, I'm like, can someone have too much money? You know, have you ever met someone really wealthy that you judged as doing something wrong? What were they doing wrong? I'm like asking them stuff to see, do they have guilt, shame, negativity? Because if they don't have the right fundamental money beliefs, they'll never be a good employee. So that's several fragments of the process right there.
I love that. I let everyone who applies with us read The Go-Giver. Same kind of thing. I want people to create value, because when you're creating and selling education, your number one priority is to create as much value on the front end for these people and show that you're in it, not just to make the money, but, you know, actually create value. So before we go into the short answers, that I created this trinity of money, I call, of being financially free. You work hard, and then you work smart, and you work with passion. So I've been hearing throughout the whole thing, you really got to put in a lot of hard work. There's a lot of hard work, but that doesn't create success, because all of a sudden you don't have enough time left, right? And right. You've got to start working, you know, in the business, you know, not just on it, but you know, you have to work really smart. And then finally you work with passion. That's when you start like, I'm not retiring. I love doing this. So as I was reading the book, it clicked at my mind, because I love that trinity. So Mr. Senziano, if you want to take away with the short answers.
Yeah, before we get there, two awesome quotes or statements I want to pull. And he was really getting into attitude over scarcity. And I think that a positive mental attitude will allow you to go fast, especially if you have self-awareness. So I just really connected with that. And then economic independence allows you to swing for the fences. That was awesome, man. So that, I really like that.
Thanks, man.
What is your best habit for success? Because we have really great people on the show all the time, and I really start to see a lot of similarities from folks. Not looking for anything like that. Love, you know, anything that you do, but I love asking everyone that question. So weekly, monthly, anything that has led to your success?
Man, narrowing it down to one. My number one technique for success is I win first, then play. So what I mean by that is, before Killing Sacred Cows was written and completed, I pre-sold 22,000 books. So I already had the momentum before the book came out, before I did my first video series. I went to our subscribers and said, hey, if you want to buy this before I film it, I'll charge you half price. I just want your feedback in exchange for the lower price. And we sold $150,000 of the video series before we filmed the first video. So for me, I win first, then I play. I think too many people play not to lose, and that's never going to get them where they want to go. They'll stay poor and middle class. Some people play to win, but at what cost? Sometimes when people play to win, they get stuck in that work, 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 and they lose their health and they lose their, you know, family and all that kind of stuff. So win then play is really just creating really like, how do I make this successful before I invest a single dollar?
So Jake, he's kind of proof of concept almost before it goes out. Yeah.
Yeah. He's talking about not working from a catabolic level of energy. He's working from an anabolic level. I mean, catabolic is draining, you know, I win, but if you lose, that's what I'm looking for. He's going, I win and you win, or else we don't play. That's basically what he's saying. So, I mean, that's some really high level stuff there.
Yeah, there's just like, I saw so many examples of this. Like when France gave the United States the Statue of Liberty, there was no platform or visitor center. So they just put out these ads in all the New York papers and said, hey, if you donate 6 cents, you could be the first to get to the visitor center. And guess what? They raised all the funds and they had all of the crowd before the thing was even erected. So I was like, how do you apply that? The NFL? We don't know if the Super Bowl is going to be a good game, but they've already sold every ticket that exists. They've already sold the TV rights. They've already got the NFL experience set up in the city in Atlanta that's coming up. So, like, they've already won before the game's even played. So how in our own lives can we win first then play? That was the four I's. That's win then play. Get money back from the IRS. Get money back from non-performing fees. Like, that's my entire methodology and mindset around things.
Just like the Patriots and Bill Belichick, just videotape everything and, you know, just cheat in the front end. You'll get it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm a Bills fan. I had a through the
journey. You figure out what everybody else is doing that you're not supposed to know.
That's it, man. What about a book recommendation? Doesn't have to be, you know, a lot of people throw out Rich Dad and everything, but I really like getting people's reading lists because, you know, I think you can learn a lot about them and there's a lot of value there. So any, you know, top two books?
Atlas Shrugged, if you can get through it, it means...
Dude, like, my guy! Oh, my man, it's about to be a bromance right now.
Look at this. So up on my shelf, this is one of the first 10,000 copies. Signed by Ayn. It's number 812 ever published. And then also dedicated to Nathaniel Brandon. And he signed it for me, too. So I've got it signed by both.
Just so you know, we're connected. We have Rand Partners, we have Rand Property Management, and we have Rand Cares. So, dude, this is the first time. So every time I'm interviewed, I always get asked that question. That's always I go right there, and this is the first time I've got it back. So man, we got a little something going on.
I'm gonna leave right now. Okay, guys, I'll see you guys later. Okay.
All right. So number two. So you threw out the obvious one for all the folks out there. What's another one?
The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Never read that.
I've heard that a few times. I haven't got to that one yet.
Yeah, it's just like I've read it multiple times because it's all about like how do you really do something at an extraordinary level and get past all the obstacles and blocks of getting there. So.
Check it out. I will check that out. What project are you excited about right now?
So I've got a brand new, I could see it on the shelf. I don't know if I could reach it right now, but I just created a thing called the Wealth Book. So this Wealth Book is, I wrote at least 4/5 of it, if not more, no ghostwriters, no other writers. I had one of my copywriters do 2 of the segments in there, but I love the voice of it, but it's gorgeous. It's this big box. I gotta pull it up. I'll show you, it'd be better to show. But I just got to climb around the office here and through the lighting and all this kind of stuff to grab it. But I think that showing it will do better justice than telling about it. So first you can see how substantial it is, right? It's got a magnet. It opens up and then bam, you've got this book. And inside the book, there's a 9-inch screen. And on the 9-inch screen, I do 3 videos, 1 on tax, 1 on cash flow, 1 on investment. Then we have long-term case studies inside of it. Then we have my origin story. And if you look at just the quality of the design and everything.
Yeah, that is just sweet.
So I have another one that we just did for a different program. And it's going to be a gray cover. And we just ordered it and it's on the way. So I'm excited for that. I'm going to launch a podcast. I did radio for 5 years. Most times it was 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I got a little bit of burnout. Part of it was because I got offered syndication from 6 to 8 p.m. at a time my wife was pregnant, having our second kid. And I turned it down because I wanted to stay married and be a good, like, she just knew. She's like, you're going to work all the way till 6 and then we're not going to see you. The kids are going to be asleep. So I lost a little steam on it. But I think you'll like the name. It's going to be called Sacrifice Shrugged. So Atlas Shrugged. I think this whole notion of sacrifice has, like, people actually believe if I give up something greater for something lesser, like retirement is sacrifice, right? Sacrifice, scrimp, and save. Budget, or I'll sacrifice my health or my family. So it's going to be it's going to be feature on quality of life, and money's part of that lifestyle. So I'm really excited for it because it's going to integrate a few different things. So.
That's really cool.
So the podcast, the book, where can people all go to get more information on this?
Wealthfactory.com/podcast. We've got some great resources there. If they want a copy of What Would the Rockefellers Do, they can just text 801-503-9667 and put WWRD in the subject line. It's on me. I'll contribute it to them. Just if you text, make sure you got to just promise me you'll read at least a page. And if you want a physical copy, I'll even send that your way. I'll pay for the physical copy. You pay for the shipping. So,
Very cool. Very cool. G-Dad, what else you got?
We could probably go for like another 3 hours now that, you know, Atlas Shrugged is on the table, right? But a lot of actual content. I'm telling you, that's what it's all about. I mean, it's all about actual content. If you don't get yourself moving after this podcast, then you're doomed because it's all about becoming financially free, being able to move down to Florida, being able to go to the beach whenever you want to, being able to jump on podcasts, and the more opportunities come your way when you're financially free. I can't explain it. Maybe Garrett can, but all of a sudden you're not worrying about making money and you're worrying about creating value for other people. It just ends up showing up in your life. And
I've got the science behind it real quick.
Yeah. I'd love to hear it, dude.
So it's called the reticular activator. So the reticular activator happens like when I bought my first car, I bought an Acura RL, and then all of a sudden I started seeing Acura RLs everywhere I went. And then when my wife was pregnant with our first son, I started seeing pregnant women. I never noticed them. And then all of a sudden I started noticing them. Or when I'm getting married, I notice there's like bridal fairs and bridal magazines. I never noticed those things. So what happens is we become more abundant and less in survival mode. Our reticular activator can see the opportunities. And then there's this other factor of when we show up with that kind of energy, like people now want to bring us opportunities, you know, because they're going, oh, dude, like, as you're sharing all the information you're sharing here and the way that you present it, I'm like, I love the way you think, right? Like, I'm interested in what you have to say beyond whatever the podcast is today because of how you show up. So there is that how you show up and who you are, but there's also that you could pay attention to those opportunities that are coming your way, that because before your mind was being used for scarcity thinking, when you're not financially free, it's used for survival, it's used for hustle. And so there's not the freedom to actually have that thought.
So I'm not going to let you off the hook. We should end it, but how do you get the reticular activator activated? I don't know what happened to me. I was just moving away from pain. I was freaking pissed off my situation. So maybe that's how I activated it. And I said, I got to do something and I want to make a little bit of money. Then I make a little more. And then it's just that momentum, like yeah. You said. So, I mean, how would you go about it?
Pain or pleasure will bring up that reticular activator, but to be really consistent with it, there was a book written in the late 70s by Stephen Covey before his, like, you know, Seven Habits book. Mm-hmm. It was a more dry book, more of a textbook. But one of the things he said was, if you take the first 30 minutes of the day for yourself, you'll transform the other 23 and a half hours. And so as I had my radio show and I interviewed so many people, I found a lot of people have rituals to start their day. And so if you begin your day, it's like the way you put on your armor of abundance. I just call it the three E's. Some degree of exercise and progress over perfection. That exercise could even be just meditation on some days because you don't need to work out 7 days a week. It could be, you know, going for a walk. Other days it might be a little bit more intense. The second one is education. So whether that's listening to a podcast, whether that's reading a book, whatever your best way of learning, and progress over perfection, done is better than perfect. You know, just commit to something. And then the third E is enlightenment, which could be anything from writing in, you know, gratitude. It could be doing meditation. It could be just creating some space to think. But if you begin your day that way, the rest of the day operates differently because you've kind of transcended some of the constraints of time because you're showing up at a better version of yourself. You'll be able to see those opportunities better. And I got to tell you, when life is tough, when circumstances are difficult, that becomes twice as important as when times are good because it helps you to get through those times without, you know, getting derailed.
Thank you. That explains a lot, Mrs. Stenziano. You got anything left, bro?
I got two things. Number one, did you see this right here? I didn't even go there. That's our company logo. Can you see that?
I do. Yeah. You got Atlas there, buddy. You're holding up the world.
So number two, I feel like I'm talking to Hank Reardon here. We got to get Gino, you know, to read the book. So can you give him? I need your best pitch to get my boy here to read this.
Dude, I look at that book.
So check this out. I had a business partner named Les McGuire, and he read Atlas Shrugged first. And he said, you should read Atlas Shrugged. And I got to tell you, the first 200 pages are tough. They're just like setting it up, and there's nothing like overly exciting. So just skip ahead to the Francisco money speech.
Yes!
Read the Francisco money speech. Like, dude, where's my other book? You know, I open with an Ayn Rand quote on What Would the Rockefellers Do? I open up with a quote where she says, you know, only he who is fit to inherit wealth will do something with it. If they're not, the wealth will destroy him. Is it money that corrupted him, or did he corrupt his money? That's the opening of, which is part of that whole speech. So
dude, that's awesome.
If you start with that speech, dude, it's hard to put down. Now, the second thing that Les did is he came to me and he said, here's the deal, man. Because he was late to meetings all the time. And I said, hey, man, I'm not setting up meetings with you anymore because you're late. And so I charged him $500 to set up a meeting. And then if he showed up to the meeting on time, I gave him his $500 check. If he didn't, I kept it and cashed it. And I didn't care about his excuses. So after he paid me $1,000, he said, well, guess what? Why haven't you read Atlas Shrugged? You told me you would read it. He goes, I'm not going to do another meeting with you until you've read Atlas Shrugged, and you only have this amount of time. So you go ahead and write me a $1,000 check. And I wrote him a $1,000 check, and then I got the reading done. Now, I got to tell you, I was crushing the reading, and I was feeling good about it. And then all of a sudden, you get to the speech in the back of the book. It's 50 pages that might as well be 500 because every word matters and counts. So I was in my garage reading at night because it was cold in the garage. It would keep me awake because I only had like 2 days, and I was trying to understand that whole speech, man. That was crazy amount of
out-of-time
info. What's that?
You're talking about John Galt's speech?
Yeah.
Did it three times, man, audio.
I've got the audio, too. I've got the and I bought it back in the day of CDs, so it's like this.
That's what I got, too. Yeah.
Wow. You guys are killing me.
So are you on board yet? Can you just do it for me, man? It's been years.
I will do it for you now that he sold me. See, it's sell or be sold, and I was just sold on it. You know what I'm saying? Francisco money speech. I got it written down.
No. Don't. You got to do the whole thing.
Read that, and then you're going to want to read the whole thing. Go, because you'll read that multiple times. But that
crystal clear, the clarity that this human being, Ayn Rand, it was just amazing how she was able to put, you know, the words on the paper, and just the clarity of thought will just, it'll blow your hair back, man. It really will. So,
yeah. I mean, dude, you're going to learn lessons about customer service in this that are like mind blowing. You're going to learn like unexpected things that way. And I really feel like this is the most seminal work that prepared me for writing Killing Sacred Cows. Because it was all about being a producer. Now, I kind of feel like Ayn Rand didn't know what quality of life really meant when it came down to it. So there's some things that are missing because she kind of died a little bit angry and unhappy. But USA Today did a survey, and Atlas Shrugged was named the second most influential book of all time next to the Bible. So it was the Bible number one, Atlas Shrugged number two on that survey. So...
You know, if she would have got a little meditation in, she would have been fine. All right.
Dude, imagine if she would have worked out. Right? She just had all this angst, and she was you know, living in communist Russia, and I think that just really she could never
good,
let
good
go.
Excuse, like, right? That's a good excuse.
Yeah, good excuse.
All right, guys, this was awesome. Garrett, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for getting the GDAT on board with Atlas, man. This is so worth my time.
Join the club.
Yes.
Thanks, Garrett. I appreciate it.
See you guys.
Thank you, everybody.
That was a ton of fun. Thanks, guys.
We trust that you enjoy the Wheelbarrow Profits podcast. Visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. See you next time when Jake and Gino share more of their investing secrets with you.